Welcome to Rewind and Digress, where we hit pause on the now and track back to one of our favourite films, discuss it at length, and then we twist and turn like a worm off topic. I'm Jarrett, and I'm with Glenn, and we're FakeShemp.net. Sean's not on the mic tonight, but he'll be back with us on another episode down the track. On this episode, we're rewinding back to 1976 for the classic eco-horror creature feature Squirm, directed by Jeff Lieberman. Now, Glenn, Squirm, when was the first time you saw Squirm? Can you remember?
Well, I can't. I have seen this film twice.
Now, Only twice?
Yes, and I hope that you have a shitload of content to go with on this because... Yeah. As familiar as I am with the film, I have only seen it twice. So right. One was many years ago. We're talking, I would have been probably 9, 10, maybe 11.
Right.
I remember it vividly. I remember watching it with my stepmother.
Right. Okay.
We watched it right after Poltergeist 2.
Oh, cool.
And I remember the linking the two in my mind because you have like this image of the guy being swallowed by a pit full of worms.
Yeah, yeah.
And in the Poltergeist, you had a woman being swallowed by a pit full of razor wire.
True, yeah.
And
yeah.
It was a very similar image in my mind. Second time I watched it was right before this podcast. So
wow,
I had to refresh
crazy.
Myself. It's a film I've always wanted to go back to.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
a film, the poster art has always been fresh in my mind. And people talk about it all the time, and I've never owned it. It's one I have lined up on many a carts to, you know, purchase.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm really glad you chose this as a focus film. So, yeah, look, my contribution to this podcast will be questionable, but, you know, I hope you've got
I'm
a shitload
I'm going to throw to you a lot.
Okay, well, you know, you can hit me with it. But, yeah, no, so that's it. You know, I remember
right,
when
right.
I did first see it. What about
Excellent.
Yourself?
Well, yeah, it's a bit of a weird one. The first time that I clearly remember watching it was on TV late at night with the old man back in maybe, I think it was about 85 or so, just before we moved to Queensland. And as we were watching it on TV broadcast, we were taping it as well to tape. And I still have that tape to this very day. It has all the ads from that era.
Did you create your own poster art for this one?
No, I didn't. Yeah, actually, the way I've written Squirm that's written on a piece of little lined paper and shoved in the case actually looks pretty crude. Looks like it's drawn by, like, you know, I think it probably was rewritten a few times, maybe when I was about 9 or so. No original artwork on this one. But that's my earliest childhood memory of the film. And I was going to mention, because you'd said you'd watched it like almost in a double with Poltergeist, is that it is a pretty family-friendly type of horror film. There is a tiny bit of nudity. You know, it's a fraction of, you know, it's a bit of boob. Someone coming out of the shower.
That's what really surprised me watching it again recently is the fact that it was family-friendly. The poster art always makes it look like a really gratuitous, gory, grotesque, almost Fulci kind of horror film.
Yeah, totally.
And it's not. You know, I was surprised. It's a slow burn film. It takes a long time for the worms to even appear.
Yeah, it's like a good 40 minutes.
Yeah,
almost,
but, you know, I would actually liken it more to your arachnophobia style of family creature feature.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what it's in line with. And I think arachnophobia took a lot of cues from it.
Yeah, and that's the funny thing. There is, since we're just discussing, I never thought about it until now.
Yep.
There is no profanity in this film at all, as far as I know. So, yeah, it is reasonably family friendly. And not that that's why I watched it with my old man. My old man and I were probably watching Texas Chainsaw in that age. But it was one that sort of stuck with me. And funnily enough, when the film actually ended and it went to the, you know, end credits and the last song plays during those end credits, the TV announcer comes on and he's like, "You've been watching Squirm, where even a worm can turn." And it was like, that was awesome. Like, I remember when I saw Extra on TV around that same era.
Yeah.
And my old man and I always remember this, but we've never heard it anywhere else, was, you know, "You've been watching Extra, the Atacuda goat." And I'm like, "What is an Atacuda goat?"
Wow.
And I Googled it. I'm like, this has never been said in reference to the film at all. But I digress. As is the name of the podcast. So getting back to the point, another memory I have of watching this film was actually the night before I got married. I was super nervous. And
were you squirming?
I don't know if squirming was the right term for it. I was in a cold sweat. I was the loneliest I'd ever been, because this is like, my wife's always at home, bless her. But this is like the only nights I had the house to myself ever. I didn't know what to do. Like, I've had the house to myself during the day, but at night I don't know what to do.
Yeah, wank.
So, yeah, well, there's that, I guess, before the wedding.
Well, it involves a worm.
Yeah, well, and it squirms. But yeah, so I actually watched this film with the audio commentary the night before I got married, because I just like needed something to kind of calm me and put me in a state where I felt comfortable enough to sleep. Meanwhile, my wife was with her bridesmaids watching my best friend's wedding. It was my DVD of my best friend's wedding. They were watching, and here I am all nerdy up watching Squirm with audio commentary at home.
Does that wedding turn out well? I think.
No, because no, yeah, the guy comes from the past that's really in love with her. Because yeah, no.
So that's
no,
the digress part of the episode. Yeah,
we digress pretty heavily. So look, for the listeners, I'm just going to read the synopsis. This is a synopsis that's been provided by MGM. It's on the MGM site, because the film's globally owned by MGM, and it's been sub-licensed by different companies all over the world to do some pretty amazing special editions, which I will touch on later.
Sure.
So here's the synopsis. During the worst electrical storm in the history of a small fishing village in Georgia, a power line topples near a worm farm and electrocutes the bugs. The electrified worms turn into man-eaters, devouring everything in their path. Now, that's a pretty good explanation of the basic story, but it tells you nothing about the characters or, you know, anything. It's just basically the worms.
Yeah,
they're electrocuted and they turn into man-eaters. So I just want to touch on a little bit of the story. So, you know, one of the themes is like it's a fish-out-of-water scenario with New Yorker Mick, which is played by Don Scardino, who I'll talk about later in the podcast. He's visiting this small southern town, you know, to see this southern belle Jerry, played by Patricia Percy. And the premise is that he's there hunting for antiques in the small town of Fly Creek, but we all know that he's actually there to get the girl. Then there's Roger, who's R.A., played by R.A. Dow, I think. Jerry's boy next door. He works at his old man's worm farm and has an unrequited love for Jerry. He also has a brilliant line. There's this one line that he has that's, "I'm just as happy as a bump on a log." What the fuck?
Oh, no.
Like, I've never heard
You've
that
really
phrase
before.
You've
really got to put yourself in the position of that bump.
I know. Yeah, absolutely.
That all depends on who sits on you.
Yeah, absolutely. Or maybe if it's Jerry. Yeah. Anyway, spoiler alert, Roger falls prey to the worms, but rather than just being killed off, he gets a face full of worms, becomes crazed, and decides he'll get Jerry at any cost. Now, Roger's makeup with that worm face was done by a very young Rick Baker.
Rick Baker, yes.
Yeah, one of his earlier works.
And look, you say spoiler alert, but that photo is
That's on everything, isn't it?
If you type in Squirm, that's the photo.
That's the thing you see. That's totally. And even the original US MGM DVD release has the imagery of Roger with the worms in his face on the cover.
Fantastic imagery.
It's great imagery. So aside from the fish out of water and eco-horror theme, Squirm touches on domestic abuse. You've got Roger, who's bullied by his father, and you've got that small town mentality and southern repression in particular. So there's a lot of things happening, and it's a very character-driven film. Like you said, it's a very slow burn film.
Definitely.
So it's very dependent on these characters and their relationships. So yeah, look, I was going to ask you, do you have any favourite scenes from the film? Having seen the film twice, what scenes sort of stuck out to you?
Well, there's two scenes actually,
right.
And I think it's more from a technological point of view that I enjoy them. The first thing that really stood out for me was just the opening scene of the power lines.
It's very cool.
Because it's miniature.
Very cool,
and I assume it's miniature.
Some of it was miniature, some of it was stock footage, some stuff that they shot, and there is actually a shot from Oceans, the original Oceans, is it Oceans 11? That's the original.
Yep.
Not obviously the George Clooney one, but the original one with the Rat Pack.
The Rat Pack one,
There's actually a shot from that, and then they've just put some effects, optical effects over the top.
I think those miniature elements of it, I always, I'm attracted to that kind of stuff.
It
really stood out. Actually reminded me a little bit of the start of The Curse. Remember that film?
Oh, yeah.
That's all miniature too, and a similar kind of setup. But then
Will Wheaton?
Yeah, very young.
Yeah.
Very poxy looking effect, but it's, very nostalgic effect.
Absolutely.
But the other one, which I think a lot of people would probably refer to, was the classic set piece with the house and the tree falling on it.
Oh, yeah. And that's all practical.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm watching that going, holy fuck, how the hell did they do this?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to rack my mind watching it. I went back and watched it a few times and trying to work out how that would, how it was done. It wasn't miniature. I'm like, that's a real tree. That's falling.
Mm.
And then to find out that there were people inside that house at the same time, and the tree falling was one take.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it crashes through the house from the interior, it's the same fall yeah. as what's filmed on the outside.
It's just another setup, but they're the same setup, but another camera in there filming.
That's amazing.
Incredible.
And the danger you put your actors in.
I know, totally. You won't get that in a Hollywood movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's
Mad Max kind of gorilla shit.
Neither of those particularly relate to the horror of the film in a direct way, but yeah, that they stood out for me.
They're great scenes, and it's funny to mention that these scenes, you know, don't directly relate to the horror of the movie, because my favorite scene from the film is not horror at all, really. It's the introduction of Mick's character in the film. It's a scene on the Butterfly Creek where they've hit a slight snag. There's a bit of flooding and some fallen debris that's preventing from the bus from reaching its end destination. Mick's forced off the bus to kind of make his way through the woods
and
there.
And then ask if there's a restroom.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, this is it. I love the interplay. I like the physical comedy of having him walk through the bus with all this unnecessary shit that he's got there. But you can tell that he's got, yeah, exactly, bumping, child crying. But he's got a fishing rod that he's brought with him, and he's got like a little, like a racket, like a squash racket sort of thing. And like, obviously, he's an antiques hunter and that. And they've still got like tags on them and stuff. But he's got like so much unnecessary shit. And the bus driver makes a crack about, you know, you've probably got a compass in there as well.
Yeah.
I just love it. Like, there's a lot of physical comedy. The interplay with the bus driver is terrific. But it also is a great scene in establishing Mick's character as like this out of towner, like this city boy, you know.
Sure.
But that's my favorite scene, which is weird, because I always think, you know, this film essentially is, you know, a horror film, but my favorite scene is like comedy. And there's a lot of comedy throughout the film.
I was just, like I said, I was trying to work out whether it was a deliberate gag for him to hop out of a bus in the middle of nowhere and then ask if there's a restroom.
Yeah.
And then it cuts to him taking a piss.
That's great.
It worked for me. Let's put it that way.
Right. Oh, it's terrific. Okay, so, you know, there's some cool things about it. One of the things I really like about it is there's this music that's throughout it, which is just sort of unsettling, kind of like very childlike sort of, you know, not lullaby, but that sort of thing. And then there's this child's voice that sings this, you know, and they sample it throughout the film. You know, I can hear the dark if I listen hard. Anyway, I believe it was like some, you know, young choir boy that they'd got from, I think they got him through the UK because it was cheaper to record this kid doing this thing over there than we're in the United States. But that really is unsettling with that imagery, especially like the dark southern sort of swampy sort of place, and hearing this childlike voice, you know, that sends shivers up my spine. But I want to digress a little. I want to talk about Jeff Lieberman, the filmmaker, because we've spoken about him before on the podcast. We dedicated an entire Fake Shemp podcast to his film Satan's Little Helper from 2004.
Which is a fantastic Halloween theme.
It's a terrific film. It's in fact his last feature film too to date. You know, he hasn't directed any more features since that. In fact, Jeff Lieberman hasn't really directed that many features. When you count them up, Squirm's his very first film from 1976. Then he went on to do Blue Sunshine, a very psychedelic film from 1977. Then it was like another 4 years later, he did that like Backwoods film Just Before Dawn. And then it was like 7 years later, he did like Remote Control. And then it wasn't until 2004 he did Satan's Little Helper. So this guy has got, you know, he's obviously chooses the projects he wants to make. He's not really a gun for hire, which I kind of really dig.
And they're films that don't necessarily have huge appeal.
No.
Like, as far if you're trying to pitch these films, you know, there's not many people that would, you know, gravitate towards them.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, even Just Before Dawn, it's kind of got that element of Deliverance about it, but it's like far later than Deliverance.
Yes.
It's not like he was ever piggybacking on a trend and went, they're making these backwards films at the moment, I'm going to make my own. Or they're making tech kind of, you know, thriller sci-fi films, I'm gonna do that. They're doing drug movies at the moment, I'm gonna do like some psychedelic horror film.
He's kind of like the Terrence Malick of the cult world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the old Terrence Malick, not the Terrence Malick we know and love now that makes a film every year that no one wants to watch.
Well, we might have the Liebman Renaissance. You know, you never know.
You never know. I was going to mention too, he has directed some other things. Like, he's filled some gaps in between the features. Like, he's done a bit of TV stuff, where the TV movies, TV documentaries. He even had a TV show that he was a series creator of, and it was like one of those dramatic reenactment ones, and it was like marriage has gone, you know, awry.
Are you kidding me?
No, yeah, dead set. But guess who hosted it?
Do you want me to guess?
Yeah, have a guess.
What era, what year?
Well, the series itself is actually from, I think, the mid-2000s.
Dean Cain.
No. Think trashy, campy American cinema throughout the 70s, 80s. And, you know, I don't think he's had a film recently, but he did do his last film from memory that I know had Johnny Knoxville in it. And it had Selma Blair, a very voluptuous...
You were talking John Waters.
John Waters hosted it.
What?
Yeah, it ran for like 16 episodes. Holy shit. Sorry, I've never seen it, but it sounds like something I need to see. But that's one of the things he's done, you know, over the course of his career, which is kind of strange. On the topic of strange careers, you've got the actor that plays Mick, Don Scardino, and he's actually, he never really did a lot of movie stuff. Like, I think he did Cruising with Al Pacino, and I can't remember any other films. But I don't even remember him from Cruising, to be honest. I saw that on IMDb.
Point proven.
Yeah, there you go. But he's a pretty prominent television director. Like, directed a lot of TV, everything from Law & Order to 30 Rock. But he did direct one feature film, and it was only a couple years ago, film that I had super high hopes for because it was like a clash of great talent, and it just didn't pan out. The Incredible Burt Wonderstone.
Are you kidding?
No, that's sad.
What?
Yeah, he directed that. Yeah, I know. I freaked out. Isn't that weird?
How does that happen?
I don't know, but the weirdest thing is I remember when I finally saw it, because I didn't get to see it at the movies. I don't know why, because it had everybody down. I wanted to see it, and then I saw it on... DVD, and it was, Blu-ray. Massive, massive letdown. But when the opening credits started and it said directed by Don Scardino, I was like, couldn't be the same Don Scardino. And it was. I jumped on IMDb and I was like, holy shit. He did direct that. And,
you would have been the only person on earth that knew the name to begin with.
I know. I think I said it to Danny. I was like, oh my God, he's from Squirm.
I need to tell everyone.
I know. Everybody needs to know. And that's when I looked and I was like, God, this guy's been directing tons of television.
Cool.
Like a lot of TV. Cool. Even more recently, he's been doing like The Adventures or what is it? No, The Incredible Kimmy Schmidt. You know, you know, Netflix series. But he does a lot of TV comedy and TV drama. So that's kind of unusual. But, for a guy that's obviously gone on to be better things, you know, in terms of a mainstream sort of way, he does look pretty fondly on his Squirm days. Like, he's participated in quite a few of the special features on the different Blu-ray releases that have been out. And I think they did like an anniversary screening of the film in New York a number of years ago. And he did a live Q&A with the director.
Well, it's the film that gave him a career, isn't it?
Well, it's true. Yeah, it did. And do you know who he beat out for the role? In this movie?
Would you like me to guess?
Yeah, take a punt.
Okay.
Apocalypse Now.
Martin Sheen.
You beat Martin Sheen out for the film. And here's a funny little anecdote I heard on one of the special features. I shouldn't admit that. I should be like, I just know this shit. He was directing an episode of The West Wing, and Martin Sheen had said to him, you beat me out for that role on Squirm. It's like, really?
He
remembers that stuff? But he just went on to do something like Apocalypse Now and that, you know.
Yeah, little I read films somewhere like that Sylvester Stallone was chasing a role in this.
Well, it's true. That was the role of Roger. And apparently he was really chasing it hard. It was before Rocky was produced. So he was having his agent call.
He was desperate to get out of the porn world.
Yeah, absolutely. And waitering, apparently. The Italian Stallion. He was making phone calls weekly to the producers to try and get the Worm movie. But that didn't really happen. Another famous actor that was vying for a part in this role was Kim Basinger as well. She wanted the role of Jerry. But I think from one of her, Jeff Liebman said, she might have been great for the role, but at the time I didn't think anyone would buy the fact that she lived next to a worm farm. And he said, obviously, in retrospect, you know, she's a big star. In retrospect, too, I know what sells a movie and teenage boys. They would want to see, you know, a Kim Basinger
character. They wouldn't give a shit.
No, but I think Patricia, I think it was Patricia, she did a fantastic job, as it were.
And who's to say would live beside a worm farm?
Yeah, exactly. Who are we to judge? Now, with regards to the, like, home entertainment releases, there's some pretty good versions out there. There's the Arrow release in the UK, and that's got a commentary track with Jeff Lieberman. That's the same commentary that's on the Scream Factory US release, and it's the one that's been kicking around since, I think, 1999 on the MGM DVD. It's also got a Q&A with Jeff Lieberman and Don Scardino from that New York screening I mentioned earlier. Really thick liner notes with articles by Lee Gambin and Callum Waddell. It's a pretty good edition.
So I don't own one, and I will be. I've actually put a couple in my shopping cart online. Right. I don't remember which one it is. What one should I be buying?
Get the Scream Factory one.
That sounded like a sell.
I know.
I didn't mean it that way, but I do want to know what's the better one to buy.
Well, look, I own both, obviously, because I'm obsessed with this movie.
Just give me one.
The Scream Factory version is arguably better. It doesn't come with a booklet, which is a shame, but it does have the same commentary track. But it's got a making of Squirm retrospective type documentary. But it's only got interviews with Don and Jeff. They're the only ones. But there's lots of anecdotes, lots of good stuff there.
But the film itself, like, transfers good on
I actually think that the US Blu-ray might be better. I think they're sourced from the same transfer.
I don't watch a lot of the supplementary content.
Yeah, well, there you go, yeah. Well, in that instance, look, you could probably go either way, to be honest. It's sort of hard to say. I think that's much of a muchness, really.
Considering that the one I just watched was on YouTube with Russian... Greek subtitles.
I watched a bit of that, with the Greek subtitles.
You know, it did the trick, but you know, I thought to myself, quality. I'd like to see this in a better definition.
No. But, probably the Scream Factory one for my money, you know. And that's the other thing, too. Both versions have newly commissioned art, but they also have a reverse sleeve where you've got the original theatrical art, which I love. And I didn't actually realize this till today. I was watching one of the special features with the wife. She wasn't really into it, but, you know, that's what marriage is about. And she said to me, because that's the other thing, the artwork for this film that you mentioned earlier, you know, quite, you know, full on.
Yeah, really grotesque.
It's Drew Struzan that did that art.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. It's Struzan art. It's classic art. And it has been my phone backdrop image. For probably about the last 4 years, maybe 5 years. I think it's gone through at least two, maybe almost three iPhones that I just... And I don't know why. Danny says, look, all your icons or apps, it's very hard to tell where they are against that backdrop. And I'm like, true, I know exactly where they are. But I look at it and I was like, I just can look at it. It's
this
just beautiful
art.
This
is a film that means a lot to you.
Yeah, it's us. Yeah, from the night before I was married to the backdrop of my phone, Squirm. Jeff Liebman, well, I love you.
Can I mention, though, the obvious that this came at a time in the 70s when there were so many environmental kind of creature feature films. Some of them, there was... Is that how you pronounce the films?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
There was Frogs, Food of the Gods.
Food of the Gods, classic.
Empire of the Ants, Trog, Grizzly,
yeah.
The Swarm, the Bees, Bug... Pigs, ape, like the time was ripe for this kind of film.
Prophecy, that's another one with the Killer Bear movie.
Wasn't there one called like Phase 4?
Oh yeah, that's the Saul Bass film. That's like, I think, I don't know how many films he went on to direct, but that's the guy that, you know, did the title sequence for all those Hitchcock films.
Yes.
He directed that. It's a very trippy, weird movie.
Yeah, right.
Like, very psychedelic type experience
cool.
film.
Cool. So, but this era was full of them, and I don't think, have we really done many environmental creature features in contemporary sort of cinema?
That's a very good question. I think, you know, Piranha maybe, you know, that's about it. That's about as close as we get to it. There's probably a lot of others. Oh, there's Sliver.
True.
You know, but that's going back a while. It was like 2007 or 2006. Yeah. It was a while
ago.
There's
just few and far between.
There's not a lot. There's probably some that are coming out as like the sort of cheap, you know, direct-to-VOD sort of fodder, but not sort of mainstream stuff. Yeah, another one from the era. Well, not even that era. It's probably more the late 80s. There was Slugs.
Yes.
As well. But yeah, look, Squirm. I think Squirm, the difference between Squirm and a lot of these films, though, these films from the 70s, is that Squirm is still amazing.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, not that the effects and things of that nature should ever date a film or make you think any less of it, but I still can look at Squirm and everything about it looks like it could have been made today. You know, some of the fashion's not so much.
I found the textures and the aesthetic, I found almost like a cross. This is a weird thing.
Yeah,
a cross between almost Texas Chainsaw Massacre and its, you know, backwoods, backcountry kind of
absolutely.
Look. And The Legend of Boggy Creek.
Yeah, like, right. Yeah.
I thought of those films when I was watching it and in a very kid-friendly kind of manner.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I wonder how much influence... What year was this made?
1976.
76.
So it's after Texas.
Yeah, so I wonder how many cues it took, because I noticed like even the camera work across the landscapes, very similar.
And
the main character is very similar to the nerdy guy in Chainsaw Massacre. I don't know. I'm just clutching at straws.
No, it's interesting you say that too, in drawing comparisons like with Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because there's some of the cinematography in Squirm, like even the... I don't know if it's been... you know, done prior to it, as far as I know, I'd never sort of seen it, is that they do actually have like the perspective, first person perspective from the worm.
Yeah.
You have a lot of this stuff. And I don't know.
We never mentioned the worms themselves. Like,
no, we haven't really spoken about them.
And micro shots of, you know,
yeah,
these vicious
absolutely.
Worms.
Yeah, that's it. And then there's stuff that they would have shot, you know, post film. They went and did all the pickups and did all the, you know, that kind of macro photography.
But this is a real worm that exists, it's a blood worm.
It
and
is.
They
yeah.
bite.
They do.
They've
they
got
do.
Fangs and
they'd
they latch
be
on.
Be like the worst kind of worm to breed to use as fishing bait.
But
because surely they would
do.
Bite you all the time.
They commonly use them as bait. And surely it's like getting a hook stuck in your finger. So the film features lots of close-ups of these fangs and retractable heads. And I think it's really, really well done. I mean, it's that cheap thing that like Spielberg did with the crocodiles or the alligators in the Temple of Doom, where they just cut to this horde of vicious creatures and we're supposed to believe that they're attacking.
Yeah.
But it works for this, and the sound effects are fantastic.
Oh, the sound effects are great. That's another thing I'll mention about the sound effects is that, you know, when you do have those worms, you know, open, you see sort of the teeth in them and that, you have that sort of, that, you know, scream. And that's the sound of a pig being slaughtered. Obviously, we know that from Carrie, because the guy that did the sound design or at least some of the sound effects on it was the same guy that worked on De Palma's Carrie, which was, what year was Carrie? It wouldn't have been that many years before.
That was 76, wasn't it?
Yeah, I feel like it was around the same time.
Yeah.
And apparently, I did read that Lieberman spoke to De Palma, because they were all in that same sort of circle, you know, a New York circle and that, and spoke to him at a point in time and said, oh, look, you know, I've got something to tell you, I don't know. And he's like, yeah, look, I already know, because whomever was the sound designer already mentioned it to me, so that's kind of cool.
Meanwhile, I'm making a film about a Stephen King adaptation. Yeah, you're making a film about worms.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah, exactly.
Killer worms.
Totally.
Yeah.
And then, but you know what he could have thrown to at that point in time? He was like, "Yeah, but how many people saw Squirm? How many people have gone to the cinema to see Phantom of the Paradise? Because this is back in like 76-ish." You know.
Snap.
So there you go.
Yeah, cool. Well, it, surprisingly, being a creature feature, didn't do many Jaws throwbacks either. I thought it might have, you know.
But there is one.
Is
it? I only noticed it on this rewatch. And that's probably because I've watched it on a 65-inch TV this time around. Yeah. And, you know, watched it probably being upscaled on a 4K player. But on the jeans of Jerry's sister, she's wearing like these sort of short jean kind of cut off things with lots of like little patches on them.
Yeah.
There's a patch on her bum and it's a Jaws patch.
Oh,
what? How awesome is that?
Yeah,
and
that is
weird.
Cool.
It's pretty cool. Like, I only noticed this time. I had to pause it and then go up to the TV and quickly inspect her buttocks.
And that's not even nostalgic because it was a film of its time.
Of its time, yeah, wow. Exactly. So it was like, you know, he was very aware of it at the time, you know. And I think that that's the other thing that I read about it was that he'd drawn a bit of influence from Alfred Hitchcock, you know, from The Birds. Yeah, and you can see that.
Can definitely see that.
You know, got that fish out of water sort of scenario.
Birds eat worms.
You know, well, there's birds that eat worms. I was going to say, you know, you've got the same sort of setup, you know, character comes to town to get their man or get their, you know, their boy, except that, you know, the character of Mick is a little bit more clean cut and nicer. Yep. He's got good intentions about him.
I guess that's a tenuous kind of stretch.
I know. Look, I'm just drawing. I'm just trying to fill some air, man. I'm trying to fill some air. Look, do you have anything else to add? Like, because I've actually got a little bit of a pre-record from John Harrison.
Who, oh, wow. I say, oh, wow. I knew that.
Oh, okay. Wow. Yeah. I was like, I thought I caught you off guard.
Oh, damn. No. But one thing to add is that I think this film should have set Liebman up for a much bigger career.
Mm.
It should have done for him what, you know, Piranha did for Joe Dante.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. And it's weird to think, you know, he went on to make a film the following year, Blue Sunshine, which I kind of think that maybe Squirm is the big film that everyone remembers from him. That's obviously the one that's the most special editions out there of the film.
Yep.
So maybe it is. But yeah, to go on and make that film the following year, Blue Sunshine, which almost I feel like, it might have been big in America, maybe when it came out, big in the drive-in circuit or 42nd Street. But it really wasn't that big here in Australia.
Yeah.
It wasn't until it hit DVD again in the 2000s that it kind of got a resurgence. But yeah, I agree. It's a little weird. And then, you know, I don't know. Yeah, he should be held in a higher regard because, you know, I'm sure you can mention these films to a lot of genre fans and they'll know the films, but they might not necessarily know Lieberman's name.
Yeah.
Now, crossing back, I just want to throw to John Harrison, who's recorded a small bit for us. He is, you know, an Australian-based film historian. He's a bit of an authority on Squirm and he's a mad avid collector of Squirm paraphernalia.
Hello, and thank you for having me on your podcast. Always a pleasure to get to talk about one of my favourite films, a film which left an indelible impact on me as a kid and which continues to inspire, influence and interest me many years later as an adult. And that is, of course, Jeff Lieberman's classic 1976 horror movie, Squirm. I had the pleasure of interviewing Jeff a short while back to talk about Squirm and his equally brilliant follow-up movie, Blue Sunshine, for an article that was published in a recent issue of the American cinema magazine, Wang's Chop. So that was a big thrill to interview the man who had traumatized me so much when I was a kid. No doubt one of the reasons why Squirm had such a big impact on me was because it was the first horror movie I got to see in a cinema environment, which I think is always a memorable experience. I was much too young to see The Exorcist, and I didn't get to see Jaws until several years after its release, when my sister took me to see it at the drive-in. I was already a budding little horror movie buff and was devouring the Hammer horror films that would show up on late night television during school holidays, as well as all the classic 1950s Universal movies like It Came From Outer Space and other B movies from that era that would screen either on the late show or as a Saturday and Sunday afternoon television matinees. Movies like The Giant Claw, The Beast with a Million Eyes, and It, The Terror from Beyond Space. But Squirm was a completely different kettle of, well, worms. I first saw it at the old East End cinema in Melbourne, where it shared a double bill with Bert I. Gordon's Food of the Gods, a very loose adaptation of the classic H.G. Wells novel. I snuck off into the city to see it one Sunday afternoon with my best friend at the time, Tommy, telling our parents we were heading to the St. Kilda Library to study and do our homework. From memory, Food of the Gods screened first, and while I thoroughly enjoyed it from start to finish, it was not the visceral experience as Squirm was. Though Food of the Gods did introduce me to the brilliant Marjo Gortner, the child evangelist turned exploitation actor whom I'm currently writing a book about. Squirm, however, hooked me from the get-go and quickly reeled me in. The film just terrorized and traumatized me, and I came out of the cinema finally realizing what it was like to be scared witless by a movie. For months, I couldn't open the door to my bedroom without visualizing thousands of hungry worms cascading down over me and devouring me, swallowing me whole. And the image of poor Roger and those worms burrowing up into his face was seared into my brain. Of course, this was a few years before home video, so you didn't have the luxury or the option to rewind a scene and study it over and over. It was just a quick, terrifying moment that my imagination no doubt made worse over time. Looking back, I think there are a number of reasons why Squirm has such an impact on me, apart from it being simply an effective horror movie that did its job and did it well. At the time, I was still doing a lot of fishing and was often going to bait farms to dig for worms, so I had a tactile knowledge of how worms felt and moved in my hand. As I grew older, I also began to develop a fascination with American Southern Gothic. The swamps, the trees, the unique Southern drawl, and the foreboding reputation the South has for its dislike of strangers, cultivated, of course, by movies like Deliverance and Southern Comfort. And I think Squirm, with its Georgia setting, provided an early manifestation of that fascination. I imagine it would have been a much different film with its original planned New England setting. I only got to see Squirm once at the cinema, but I never forgot the experience. I soon afterwards managed to find a copy of the paperback tie-in novelization written by Richard Curtis, which I recall reading by flashlight while on school camp at Hepburn Springs, skipping to the best parts to read aloud to the others in my tent. It made for a memorably creepy night. I also found a copy of Famous Monsters of Filmland number 130 from December 1976, which had an article on Squirm that I stared at and read over and over. Squirm, the story of a billion deadly ravenous worms, the cover blurb screamed. My next viewing of Squirm didn't come until the early 80s when it was released locally on VHS, on the classic Palace Explosive label. It was the movie that made me sign up as a member of the local video library, even though I didn't have a VCR yet at the time. I would rent Squirm whenever I was heading to see a relative or friend that I knew possessed a video player, usually being greeted with a groan and a roll of the eyeballs when I showed up at the door with it clutched in my hot little hands. I also recall the film showing up on TV around this time, usually in the 3 a.m. time slot, and I would always make it a point to set my alarm clock so I could get up and watch it. To date, I have probably watched Squirm dozens of times, and while its initial shock value may have worn off somewhat over the years, it remains a very atmospheric and well-made fright flick with great characters and nice performances and a terrific soundtrack that is very creepy and ambient, not to mention the use of a love ballad over the closing credits, which seems so out of place but only adds to the movie's oddness. My obsession with the movie has also extended to collecting any memorabilia from it that I've been able to locate. Over the years, I have managed to obtain 3 paperback tie-ins with varying cover designs, the Super 8mm Home Digest reel put out by Ken Films, along with several different VHS releases and many foreign posters, lobby cards, still sets, press books, and the Japanese souvenir booklet. I'm always looking to add to the collection, and hopefully someday it will be put to good use as a Blu-ray extra or as part of an exhibition. I am always hopeful that Jeff Lieberman will be flown over to Australia for a retrospective screening of his work, so I can thank him in person for making me squirm in terror for these past 40 plus years.
thanks, John, for sending us that piece. And look, if you've got nothing further to add, Glenn, I think that's a pretty good note to end this on.
Definitely is. I would just add that I do like the word squirm.
I do too. There's actually a t-shirt label out of Brisbane called Squirm, and they've copied the logo, but I believe they got permission from Jeff Lieberman to do so. But they do like a prints of like 70s and 80s exploitation type films or genre films, but they've got that Squirm logo. I mean, like, Squirm's such a great word.
It's an icky word.
It's such an underutilized word. It's like moist. Squirm moist. Anyway, you just think about that until we'll be back with the next episode in the next month's time. But I do want to plug another podcast. It is our other podcast, Franchise.
Franchise. It's a podcast where we take a look at a different movie franchise per episode and just, you know, talk about the sequels more than the origins. And our previous one was Vacation, and we've got something exciting coming up on the next one.
It's a Squirm podcast where we talk about all the Squirm sequels. Oh, no, they never made any. Fuck them. Sorry. Anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll be back soon.